We change topic. And the topic for this afternoon is the visibility and legal positivism, or visibility of the legal positivism.
Okay. Well, as Jordi intimated, this is on how the concept of the feasibility affects at all, if it does at all, positivism. And I was asked to write on this for the volume that Jordi and Giovanni are putting together, and it was a privilege to be asked to do this, and this is the result. And this is the first time I've tried this out on an audience, so I hope you'll bear with me. I hope it makes some sense. So my question is the feasibility a phenomenon that generates some trouble for legal positivism? Does it provide good reason to reject positivism in favor of some alternative conception of law? In other words, does it show that positivism is itself, as Jordi said, defeasible? Now, how we answer those questions will depend, I think, on a number of factors, and not least of which is exactly what we mean by the term defeasible, what it is that's said to be defeasible, the object of defeasibility, we might say, and whether the kind of defeasibility we have in mind is thought to be a necessary feature of that object, or only something that it's capable of possessing. Now, a quick survey of the literature on defeasibility, and it's an enormous literature I discovered, reveals that there are many different questions and many different issues in play when the subject of defeasibility in law is brought to the forefront. And so it's impossible to consider the relationships, if any, between defeasibility and positivism without being a little bit clear on which type of defeasibility and what kind of object is in question. So bearing all that in mind, and consideration of the fact that we're all a little tired and well-fed, I'm going to propose to limit my focus and proceed in the following way. I'm going to begin by introducing and explaining a distinction I draw between moral and legal defeasibility. I'm then going to attempt to explain the various respects in which law is, for a legal positivist, morally defeasible, and what exactly that means and entails. My next step is to consider how far a positivist can go in accommodating two claims. First, that legal rules, claims, and arguments are what I'm going to call epistemically defeasible. And second, that these are what I call logically defeasible. And as we're going to see, there is, perhaps surprisingly, much that a positivist can easily accept in the way of both epistemic and logic defeasibility. And I'm going to conclude with the possibility that property, defeasibility, might even attach, if conditions are right, to legal validity. To legal validity. Now, the precise nature of positivist conditions of validity have, as you all know, been a controversial subject in recent years. And positivists like me, who defend inclusive positivism, argue that among the possible conditions for legal validity accepted in a legal system is that the rule, contract, will, whatever it is you have in mind, must satisfy certain moral conditions, say compatibility with norms of fundamental fairness or moral equality or some such property. Others who defend what is now called exclusive legal positivism deny all that. They insist, for a variety of theoretical reasons, having mainly to do with the law's capacity to provide authoritative guidance, that legal validity must always, in all systems of law, be determined by non-moral, source-based, as they're called, criteria. And so I'm going to conclude my presentation with a few thoughts on whether the notion of defeasibility might provide a novel means of bringing those two sides together in a way that does justice to the thoughts of each side, or the insights of each side. And I think maybe it could. Okay, so that's where I'm going. The first distinction is between moral and legal defeasibility, as I call it. Now, I begin with this observation. Legal positivism is often taken, and I think quite mistakenly, to be committed to a particular theory of legal obligation or duty. This is a theory of obligation that's well captured by Bentham's advice, quoting him, to obey punctually, to censor freely. Now, according to that particular rendering of legal positivism, though existing law is always something I am free to criticize on or condemn on moral grounds if I see fit to do so, there nevertheless remains upon me an obligation always to obey it, at least till such time as the law has changed, maybe in response to my moral criticisms of it. An analogous point is sometimes made in relation to judges and how they should go about deciding cases. Positivism is sometimes thought to entail a particular theory of judicial obligation, one which requires judges always to apply existing rules of law, regardless of any injustice which could result from their doing so in particular cases. And this, it's often said, or at the very least hinted, is enough to discredit positivism as not only a descriptively inaccurate theory of legal practice, it's also revealed to be a soulless, perhaps even pernicious, theory, unworthy of acceptance by any morally responsible agent. But none of that's even close to being true. The truth of the matter, I think, is that positivism in no way entails any such obligations. That the existence of valid law is one thing, its moral merit another thing entirely, is, I believe, a thesis which stands in easy union with the theory according to which I am morally at liberty, maybe even required, to disobey valid law when morality demands that I do so. In other words, that legal validity and moral merit are conceptually distinct properties, separability thesis, is a fact, according to the positivist, which in and of itself has absolutely no bearing whatsoever on what morally I ought to do. In short, there's nothing in the positivist theories of law and legal validity which entails any particular theory of moral obligation. And it's crucial to stress that that claim extends to judges and their adjudicative obligations. To be sure, the law itself may explicitly demand that judges apply any and all valid laws, regardless of their views on its moral merit. In other words, the system's rules of adjudication, to echo Hart again, may, as a matter of fact, prohibit judges from declining to apply valid laws on moral grounds. It's also true that, morally speaking, the institutional role of any judge in any minimally just legal system always brings with it a special moral duty to apply some laws which are found morally wanting, just as it's the institutional role of any policeman in any minimally just system to enforce at least some laws with which he disagrees morally. There are, I think, sound moral reasons why judges and policemen should not, given their official roles within a legal system, be at liberty to pick and choose which laws to apply or enforce. These reasons have to do with familiar things like the need for effective authoritative law within a complex society in which people disagree morally, and the fact, if it is a fact, that someone else with the authority to do so has deliberated in good faith about which laws are best to introduce and has decided to introduce the particular law in question, and so on. Despite all that, and there's a lot to that, we must continue to insist on one absolutely crucial point, I think. Morality, including the requirements it places on people serving special institutional roles, like judges, is not completely indifferent to the circumstances in which these people are sometimes called upon to act in discharging their institutional responsibilities. It's not indifferent, for example, to the degree of injustice that might result were a duly adopted, legally valid rule applied by a judge to a particular set of facts. And the same goes for our sometimes unfortunate police officer. He is no more under an absolute, unconditional moral duty to enforce each and every law, come what may, than I think a soldier is under an absolute, unconditional moral duty to obey any and all military orders, including, for example, a grossly immoral order to slaughter innocent villagers. In this sense, then, laws are, judge and police officer, morally defeasible. Indeed, all reasonably just legal systems recognize this inescapable fact, and many, as a result, call on judges, though not police officers, sometimes to change or otherwise alter the force or effect of the law so as to avoid applying it in such deeply problematic cases. As all contemporary positivists are happy to assert, the law typically includes the grounds for its own development, reinterpretation, and change in the course of its application to particular cases, including the kinds of cases now under consideration, circumstances in which there are overwhelming moral reasons to seek a way to avoid applying a law. In such instances, the law can quite sensibly be said to be not only morally defeasible, but legally defeasible as well. In other words, subject to defeat for legally sanctioned moral reasons, so as to escape its otherwise binding effect. Now, I'm going to return to those points a little bit later in more detail. But the only thing I want to stress at this point is this. Even when the law fails to enable a judge to avoid in some way the application of a valid law on moral grounds, the judge always, of necessity, retains this residual moral right. Indeed, I would insist the moral duty not to apply the law if doing so would lead to gross injustice. And in that sense, it remains for him morally defeasible. The law cannot strip a judge of her moral autonomy. It cannot expect her to check her moral scruples at the door when she enters the courtroom. It cannot do this any more than it can require us to check our moral autonomy at the door when we enter a civil society governed by the rule of law. So my conclusion in this section is that there is an important sense in which the law always is, of necessity, morally defeasible. And that extends to all of us, citizen, policeman, judge, for whom Bentham's prescription to obey punctually may well stand as sound advice, as what we might call a useful practical guide or rule of thumb, which normally finds its way into what R.M. Hare once called our intuitive level of moral thinking. By that we mean this. It's a prescription, always obey the law, which we are rational to adopt and follow in the normal course of events. But its adoption must always be accompanied by two important caveats. First, the prescription applies only when both our society and its legal system are reasonably just. And second, the obligation to obey, apply, or enforce always remains at best and of necessity prima facie. And in that crucial sense, it's a moral obligation that is inherently defeasible, and necessarily so. To think that a positivist has to deny this is, I think, to mistake his theories concerning legal validity and the nature and structure of legal systems for a very crude theory of moral obligation, one calling on unconditional allegiance and obedience to law. And I add this final editorial comment: how anyone could saddle morally sensitive proponents of positivism like Hart, Raz, Gardner, Green, and so on with such a monstrous theory is really quite a mystery, at least to me it is. Okay, so that's all. That's moral and moral defeasibility. I'd like now to turn to what I'm going to call logical and epistemic defeasibility, and just trying to carve up this very complex terrain into some manageable pieces. And so I introduce this distinction between logical and epistemic defeasibility, which is implicit in the literature, I think. Sometimes I think the term defeasible is used to denote a kind of epistemic defeasibility. And that attaches not to rules, claims, or arguments that we find in legal practice, but to our knowledge of these things and the degrees of certainty we can achieve with respect to those things. Essentially, at the bottom line, what's being said is that no claim to legal knowledge is completely impervious to challenge or reasonable dispute. That's something that Neil McCormick has written a lot about. But if this is what is being claimed, that all legal claims to knowledge are in principle contestable, can be defeated, then we can readily agree. This will be so even in respect of those cases where no one would seriously entertain a challenge. That is, where the only kind of doubt one could seriously entertain would be founded on some kind of radical Cartesian skepticism of a highly speculative sort. But it will also be true in many other cases, including those where a legal official has made an authoritative decision on a genuinely contestable issue. In that kind of case, the law may not give us standing to challenge the official's claim legally, say by granting us leave to appeal the authoritative decision, any more than it would in the former case, where nothing but Cartesian skepticism applies. But it remains true, nevertheless, that both the decision and any claim one might make in dispute of it is inherently defeasible. That is, subject to the response that the decision maker just got things wrong. In law, we never achieve absolute certainty any more than we do in any other domain of practical reasoning. But now we face a far tougher question. Do the observations I've just made pose any particular problem for positivism? Sorry, it seems like a truism that all claims in law are defeasible in that sense. Does that pose a problem for positivism? It's difficult to understand why those claims would, unless one assumes for some reason that positivists view law as seriously wedded to the pursuit of absolute certainty as its defining goal or ideal, or perhaps cognate goals like unassailable authoritative guidance or conclusive settlement of disputes, as Larry Alexander talks. Now, it's easy to see how one might make this assumption, if only because some prescriptive or normative positivists, as they're sometimes called, do seem to view the achievement of a very high level of certainty or authoritative conclusive settlement as one of law's defining goals. And even those positivists who would reject any such view do speak of the certainty which law is capable of introducing into our practical reasoning as one of its central virtues. Now I'm going to bring in Hart again. Remember, he referred to what he called the defect of uncertainty, which inevitably plagues all but the most close-knit of pre-legal societies. And then he went on to characterize his famous rule of recognition as a remedy for that defect. Now, it's very tempting to infer that even a positivist like Hart views certainty, the achievement of certainty, as a central goal of legal practice, as part of his raison d'etre, so to speak. And if we make that inference, then we might be led to view epistemic defeasibility as a serious threat to positivism, because it defeats the very purpose of having law if we've got this defeasibility at play. But that would be a mistake. As Hart himself notes, and as I was going on about this morning in my presentation, legal systems routinely balance values like certainty, predictability, it's the wine talking, and stability against competing values, including the need for flexibility at point of application, as I was saying, to avoid morally troubling results. As Hart tells us, rules are often drafted in very open textured terms, leaving room for consideration of contentious background moral reasons when the rules are applied by citizens and judges. As I was saying, instead of trying to craft detailed, closely textured rules in the futile bid to achieve some elusive degree of absolute certainty, that's simply not possible, rule creators often employ these very open textured terms like reasonable, due care, and fair, and so on. Now the point here is that the measure of uncertainty that's undoubtedly introduced by the use of such inherently contentious, often morally laden terms is wisely accepted in legal systems as a cost well worth paying for the sake of these other values. These are values which would be seriously compromised were rule makers to opt for much more concrete rules in some kind of misguided bid to achieve absolute certainty. So, the fact that law is inherently defeasible, that claims are always defeasible, you never know for certain whether what you believe to be the law is in fact the law, poses no particular difficulty for positivists. It appears to do so only if we saddle them with some kind of oversimplified theory of law's defining ideals or purposes. But that's a theory to which no plausible version of positivism that I know of is wedded. But that brings me now to what I call logical defeasibility. Suppose the reply was made as follows. True, we can never achieve absolute certainty in law, even if for some misguided reason we tried to do so. And I'll admit, critic says, all positivists recognize this. But what if legal rules are logically defeasible? Okay, and that's the next topic. If they were logically defeasible, would the degree of uncertainty introduced by that property if that were actually an inherent feature of legal rules, would that introduce more uncertainty than any positivist could possibly accept? Do we have a feature of law here which shows the sheer folly of viewing law as positivism proposes? Well, once again, I think we have to be careful and respond, it depends on what exactly we mean here. It depends on the kind of logical defeasibility one has in mind. And there are lots of them, I think. I'm going to carve out five different types of logical defeasibility when it comes to rules. And I'm going to begin with two types which obviously don't provide any difficulty for positivism. Let me begin with the following observations. Legal rules sometimes have explicit exceptions. In other words, sometimes there is a finite class of exceptions to a rule, each of whose members has been explicitly stated, either in the rule itself or perhaps somewhere else in the law. In such an instance, one might be inclined to express the point by saying that a full and accurate statement of the rule would end with the word unless. And that's a harking back to Hart, who introduced this whole controversy by saying that sometimes rules end with the word unless. And people have been trying to figure out for a long time what that means and so on. And that's, I think, what this is all about. However, a fair better way to put the point would be to say that a full and accurate statement of the rule will take something like the following form. And I've got that up on the screen there. One is forbidden from doing M, defined as A, B, and C, unless X, Y, or Z. For example, criminal codes often list a number of conditions under which someone can be said to have committed murder. That would be M. For example, S has taken a life. That would be A. Has done so knowingly. That would be B. And so on. But typically, criminal codes also specify a number of defenses. For example, that one was acting from self-defense. That might be X. Or under duress or necessity. That might be Y. That one was suffering from some disease of the mind or subject to an irresistible impulse, as the Americans sometimes describe it. And so on. That could be Z. Right? Now, if any of these latter conditions applies, the effect will be to negate or defeat the claim that S has committed murder, even though A through C obtain. S will either be found guilty of a lesser offense, like involuntary manslaughter, or exonerated entirely, as is normally the case with self-defense. But though the murder rule is subject to these exceptions, it's important to stress that these form a closed set of members of which the law itself specifies in advance. And one who sought to express fully the rule governing murder would be obliged to include each one of the specified exceptions in her statement of the rule. Okay, that's one kind of defeasibility, and arguably that's what Hart had in mind here. A second kind of non-problematic defeasibility, non-problematic for the positivist, is exemplified by the doctrine of federal paramountcy, which is sometimes employed in federal states to deal with conflicts between federal and state or provincial law. That might be the case in Spain. I'd like to know whether that's the case. That's the way the Canadian courts deal with it. In cases where the two conflict, you've got a federal law and a state law, and they lead to opposite results in some case, legal systems will routinely give preference to a federal law, at least to the extent of the conflict. And that's what they do in Canada. And by this I mean that the state law remains valid, determines results in any other cases in which there is no conflict. In such scenarios, you could quite sensibly say that the state laws are always subject to defeat by a paramount federal law. In both kinds of cases, rules with explicit exceptions, and cases where rules are overridden because of something like the doctrine of federal paramountcy, we find nothing to give positivists any cause for concern. But those who say that legal rules are defeasible sometimes mean something quite different. from either of those two unproblematic things. They don't mean that sometimes rules from one authoritative source are defeated by rules from a superior source. That's the paramountcy example. Nor do they mean that sometimes the full and accurate statement of a legal rule ends with the word unless, followed by a closed, finite set of defeasibility conditions. Rather, the claim is that the set of conditions under which any legal rule can be defeated is logically open, so that a full and accurate statement of a legal rule will always take the following form. One is forbidden from doing F unless, and then dot, dot, dot. It's left open. Or if the rule, or if it's a rule which includes explicit exceptions, a full and accurate statement of the rule will take something like this form. One is forbidden from doing F unless X, Y, and Z, or dot, dot, dot. Now the point is that in both these instances, the rule statement includes conditions which have not been specified in advance. Indeed, which might not even be possible to specify in advance, even by Dworkin's Hercules or the most enlightened of rulemakers. Now the question is, would that particular kind of defeasibility pose a problem for positivism? Once again, I want to begin by saying it depends. If what is at play here is moral defeasibility, then as I argued before, no remotely plausible version of positivism would deny the claim being made. No positivist denies that we must sometimes decline to obey or apply valid legal norms for compelling, overriding moral reasons. So that's not problematic. But what if the defeasibility is legal? That is, what if the claim is that any legal rule is always subject to legal defeat by an open-ended set of competing considerations? Is this more than any positivist can accept? Again, we have to step back and entangle, I think, a number of different possibilities. Let me back up a little and try to summarize what I think I've got to so far. There are a number of different ways in which the force of a legal rule can be logically defeated. Two of which I've already considered. A legal rule can have built-in exceptions. Two, legal rules are subject to being overridden in a manner exemplified by the federal paramountcy doctrine. But as I noted, those don't exhaust the possibilities. And there are at least three more that we have to consider. Sometimes a legal rule can be changed by a judge in such a way as to avoid applying it to the facts of the case. And you can think of that as a kind of defeat. The rule is defeated by being changed so as to avoid its effect upon the case. This third type of logical defeasibility involves an actual change in the rule. But now we've got another possibility. What if the rule remains unchanged, but the decision is taken simply not to apply it? Might be thought that here we have a fourth kind of logical defeasibility, one which attaches not so much to a rule, perhaps, but to its force. The force of the rule can be defeated. And finally, we have a fifth possibility, that a rule is defeated by being reinterpreted in such a way that it no longer applies to the facts of the case. And those are three additional ones that I want to consider. I'm going to begin with the first one, defeat by changing the rule so that it no longer applies. As Joseph Raz pointed out in his early response to Ronald Dworkin, legal systems typically provide for their own development. Often they do so by providing the judge with a directed power to change a rule at point of application. This is a Hofeldian power to change the law, coupled with a legal duty to exercise that power when the right circumstances arise. These circumstances often include the ones where there are morally compelling reasons not to apply the otherwise applicable law to a particular case. In such instances, the law can quite sensibly be said not only to be morally defeasible, but legally defeasible as well. That is, subject to change for legally sanctioned moral reasons so as to escape the effect of the rule. It's defeated in that way. So, what Dworkin took to be a counterexample of the positivist so-called model of rules valid laws, as the positivist supposedly must conceive them, being defeated by non-binding, non-legally valid principles of political morality, was an actual fact, Raz argued, an example of how law itself regulates its own development. To see this, take common law rules as the example. A judge faced with an applicable rule established by a superior court is normally bound by it, despite any problematic result to which the rule might seem to lead in the case before him. He's bound to apply the rule, even if he would have preferred a different rule, and even if there are reasons of some appreciable weight which suggest that the law could profitably be changed. The need to secure values like certainty, stability over time, predictability, and maybe even fairness to those people previously judged on its basis, argue strongly in favor of sticking with an established rule. However, if the result of doing so is, say, clearly absurd or repugnant, it's a lovely old English expression, irrational or perhaps grossly unfair, which is another phrase that pops up every now and then, and I add, not just a little unfair, but grossly unfair, then the judge will typically be empowered to change the rule to avoid that result. Now, it's important to stress that the law does not attempt to spell out the precise conditions under which these results obtain, under which the judge is empowered to do that. Rather, it leaves it to the informed judgment of the court to make the decision on its behalf. It's equally important to stress that the law does not, in providing judges with directed powers to change the law in these ways, declare open season on its rules. We're not led to legal realism. Not any old reason of whatever importance or weight will serve to engage the directed power to change the law. That's the point behind using words like grossly unfair and absurd, instead of less dramatic phrases like, well, unfair or undesirable. The result has to be grossly unfair before you can change it, change the rule. So these kinds of phrases, grossly unfair, absurd, or repugnant, emphasize that the reason must be of sufficient weight to outweigh all the competing values which argue heavily in favor of consistency with the past. In other words, staying with the rule despite its limitations. In any event, what we have here, I think, is a case of law regulating its own development by the interaction of duty-imposing and power-conferring rules. And we can understand this as invoking a kind of defeasibility. And there's absolutely nothing in this which should trouble the positivist. Okay, so that's the third kind of defeasibility, logical defeasibility. I want to turn now to the fourth kind, where the rule remains unchanged, but the rule is simply not applied in order to avoid a result which is in some way troubling. That's what I call selective application without change. Now, according to Dworkin's construal of rules, rules as opposed to principles are, as a matter of sheer logic, never subject to that kind of defeat. He famously wrote at one point in Taking Right Seriously, quote, if the facts a rule stipulates are given, then either the rule is valid, in which case the answer it supplies must be accepted, or it's not, in which case it contributes nothing to the decision. Others take the opposite tack. They say that rules are always subject to this kind of defeat and are therefore subject to a kind of open-ended logical defeasibility. I think both positions are mistaken. The doctrine of federal paramountcy illustrates the error in Dworkin's view. The answer provided by a conflicting state law may be rejected without the rule's invalidity following as a logical or legal consequence. As for the opposite view, that rules are always subject to non-application if there are good reasons to warrant that result, that can't be right either. As Fred Schauer and many others have argued, it's in the very nature of a rule that it must be, to some degree at least, entrenched against rival background considerations, as Fred calls them. Otherwise, what we have is something other than a rule. Now, it doesn't follow from that, of course, that a rule must be, as Dworkin seems to suggest by its very logic, it must be, entrenched completely against every conceivable background consideration. But there is no denying that it must be entrenched to some degree against some of them. At the very least, background reasons cannot outweigh or override the force of the rule unless, given the particular facts of the case before the judge, they are especially weighty or especially important, absurd, repugnant, etc., etc. Now, what follows from all that is that one can be sensibly said to be bound by a rule only if one is not entirely at liberty to refrain from applying the rule, or to change it, too, for whatever reason of whatever weight one cared to mention. For one would not, under those conditions, have a rule at all. And it further follows that were it true that all legal rules are of necessity logically defeasible in that very strong sense of the term, in other words, anything goes to defeat the rule in its application, then there would be no possibility of ever establishing the rule of law. After all, if one is to have the rule of law, we need rules by which we are bound in the standard run-of-the-mill cases. So open-ended defeasibility of the kind that I'm now considering would indeed pose a great problem for positivists who believe that law is fundamentally a rule-governed enterprise. But, hasten to add, that would be true of any theorist who viewed law this way. That is, who viewed law as Fuller once characterized it, as the attempt to subject human conduct to the governance of rules, understood as rules, norms, principles, and so on. And no one, save a few radical rule skeptics from Milan, view laws in any other way. This leaves our fifth way in which the force or effect of rules can be subject to logical defeasibility, reinterpretation. That's the next one. Now, it's sometimes said that legal rules are always subject to rival interpretations. You don't like the result dictated by a rule? Give a different interpretation. Now, if that view is correct, then legal rules end up being subject to the same kind of open-ended defeasibility that I discussed a few moments ago. And we have another kind of radical rule skepticism, which denies that there are really rules at all. But I don't think that brand of skepticism is any more plausible than the previous one. To be sure, rules are often subject to rival interpretations. Nobody can deny that. And judges do sometimes, and sometimes they have no choice, choose interpretations which permit them to avoid the kinds of deeply problematic results that I discussed earlier. But as before, there are limits to this particular avenue of escape, ones which largely follow the lines that I sketched earlier. The reason to depart from the standard reading of a rule must be one which the law itself recognizes and which is of sufficient weight or importance to outweigh the competing considerations which argue in favor of sticking with what we might call the standard reading. Now, of course, what I just said presupposes an important fact that for at least most legal rules, it's possible to identify what I just called the standard reading of a rule. But it's just that, the skeptic will argue, that must be denied. There are no standard readings in the law, just competing interpretations, from which judges are totally at liberty to choose. To use Hart's now classic terminology, there is no core of settled meaning surrounded by a penumbra of uncertainty. It's just all penumbra. But is that radical view correct? Once again, I want to suggest legal practice suggests otherwise. Most legal systems begin with what in common law systems is called the literal rule, according to which legal rules are to be read, so far as possible, in terms of their ordinary plain meaning. And when the area of the law in which the rule figures, think here of tax law once again, has developed its own technical meanings to deal with situations ill-suited for description through use of ordinary language, technical legal meaning is what usually governs interpretation. Standard meaning, understood in either of those two ways, is almost always the starting point. And quite often it's the end point. To be sure, it's not always the end point. Sometimes a compelling reason or argument of some sort will point toward an alternative reading of the rule. But as before, not any old reason or argument will do. Now I'm going to draw your attention to an old classic English case, Beck v. Smith, and I've got the quotation up here. This is a case from, when was it? 1836. The court said it's a very useful rule in the construction of a statute to adhere to the ordinary meaning of the words used and to the grammatical construction, unless that's at variance with the intention of the legislature to be collected from the statute itself or leads to any manifest absurdity or repugnance. There's that phrase that I was using before. In which case, the language, they said, may be varied or modified so as to avoid such inconvenience, but no further. Now, that view was later endorsed in another old English case, Gray v. Pearson, 1857, where the court said, the grammatical and ordinary sense of the words is to be adhered to, unless that would lead to some absurdity or inconsistency with the rest of the instrument, in which case the grammatical and ordinary sense of the words may be modified so as to avoid the absurdity or inconsistency, but again, not further. That's what's sometimes called the golden rule of interpretation. And I think it illustrates the points that I've been trying to insist upon. Legal meaning is typically defeasible, no question, but never in an entirely open-ended way, which would threaten the very rule of law. We must typically start with standard meaning, and this will, in almost all run-of-the-mill cases, be our end point as well. When competing reasons argue for a non-standard reading, these must be legally sanctioned reasons, and they must be of sufficient weight or importance to outweigh the many reasons arguing against such a move. And if I'm right about that, then we find here, once again, nothing which should concern the positivist. Okay, now I'm going to turn to the final section in which this is really tentative. I'm going to be interested to hear what you all think about this. The notion of defeasible validity and whether it can be useful in trying to understand what inclusive and exclusive positivists have been arguing about for, it seems like, forever. Contemporary legal positivism claims that laws exist only when they satisfy certain conditions or tests of validity, which have a special social source. Most positivists are happy to say, along with Hart, that these special tests of validity find their footing in a socially constituted rule of recognition, a rule derived from the actual practices of legal officials in identifying the valid laws that they are charged with applying, interpreting, or changing if they have the directed power to do so. Valid laws are those which satisfy those tests contained within the system's rule of recognition. Now, all positivists more or less agree with this particular picture. There are some variations, but they pretty much agree with that, the general thrust of that picture about the nature of legal validity. Where the controversy breaks out is over the precise nature of the tests of validity that one could find within a rule of recognition. And as I noted at the outset, defenders of inclusive positivism, or ILP as I'm going to call that view, argue that rules of recognition can include moral conditions. There's nothing in the theoretical commitments of positivism which rules this out, say defenders of ILP. Defenders of exclusive legal positivism, or ELP, deny this. They insist, for a variety of theoretical reasons, having mainly to do with the law's capacity to provide authoritative guidance, that legal validity must always be determined by non-moral source-based criteria, as they're called. And what they have in mind are things like legislative enactment, adoption by a court to decide a case, saying a precedent, a decision made on this, and so on. But that leaves the defenders of ELP with a puzzle. How to explain the apparent fact that the constitutions of many nation states appear to include moral tests for legal validity? The prime example is the Due Process Clause or the Equal Protection Clauses of the U.S. Constitution, and then we've got the equality provisions of the Canadian Constitution and the Spanish Constitution and so on. Now, according to those who espouse ELP, exclusive positivism, these clauses do not actually express moral conditions on validity. Rather, they express moral conditions which trigger the judge's directed power to change the law. The requirement that Congress enact no law which violates due process is not appearances to the contrary, a condition of legal validity in the United States. Rather, it's a moral ground upon which American courts are empowered to invalidate, by their decision to strike it down, what was till that point in time, that is, till they struck it down, perfectly valid law. So long as the legislation in question satisfied all the relevant non-moral source-based tests for validity, for example, it received majority approval in both the House and the Senate, was not vetoed by the President, then it was, and still is, valid law. And this is so even if, as a matter of objective fact, the legislation that was passed violates due process. It was and is valid law, till such time, if such a time ever comes about, as a judge makes it invalid by invoking her directed power to strike it down for due process reasons. Now, defenders of ILP, the view that I've historically been associated with, are by and large unhappy with that directed power's account of constitutional moral provisions. Their response is that the account falsely characterizes how an act of legislation which violates a constitutional moral provision, like due process or equal protection, is typically treated and understood. It's not treated by most legal systems and people who think about their constitutions as a candidate for invalidation by the judiciary. Rather, a law that violates due process is treated and thought as if it never was valid law because it failed to satisfy those conditions. That's the way people think about constitutional conditions. Now, there's little question, I think, at least to my mind, that ILP defenders are correct, that any enactment or decision which violates a constitutional moral clause is generally taken to be legally invalid, not simply a candidate for invalidation by the judge's directed powers. But it's equally obvious that until such an enactment or decision is challenged in court and declared unconstitutional by the court, it tends to be accepted in practice as though it were valid law. Indeed, there probably are, at any given moment in time, many such enactments and decisions, many laws, which in fact violate a constitution's moral provisions. But they're never challenged on those grounds. And these are all accepted and practiced as valid law on a routine basis. People are married under these laws. People come to agreements in under contract law, et cetera, et cetera. Now, should I choose on grounds of due process, if I were an American, not to comply with any such enactment or decision, which has not yet been challenged in court, then in all but the most unusual cases, the court will, to paraphrase John Austin, reveal the error of my ways by sticking me in jail, seizing my property, or doing to me whatever it is that the law designates as appropriate treatment for one who stands in violation of that particular enactment or decision. Austin's dramatic example is they take you out and hang you, thus demonstrating the error of your natural law theory. So, there's a strong inclination to say, along with those who advocate ELP, that so long as the enactment or decision satisfies the non-moral source-based tests of validity specified in the rule of recognition, it's valid law. Because that's the way it's treated. That's practiced. Subject, of course, to the directed power of a judge to make it invalid when and if the judge strikes it down. But valid nonetheless. Now, space prevents me from exploring these deeply contentious points further in any great detail. Instead, I'm going to throw out an idea that I'd like to test on you. And admittedly, this is sketchy, and I have to work it out yet, and I'd be grateful for any help I can get. I'm wondering whether we might have here, in the notion of defeasibility, a means of resolving this impasse between these two views, which each of which seems to account for something that appears to be true about our understanding of legal validity in these cases. And here's the possibility I want to consider. Defenders of ELP, exclusive positivism, may be correct when they say that legal validity is normally, and in the first instance, established by way of non-moral source-based criteria validity. You want to know what stands as valid law in your community? Ask yourself which rules have a source in legislative enactment, judicial decision, or some other kind of official act recognized as establishing law, executive order, for example. Normally, that's all you have to consider. And if you rest content in your life with following rules which derive from these sources, you'll be said to have lived up to your legal obligations. However, many systems also recognize that some of its laws, duly established in these ways, actually violate important rights of political morality, such as the right to due process, or the right to equal treatment before and under the law, and so on. All those classic moral provisions in constitutional documents. And so the decision is made by those who draft the system, who create the system, to include respect for these rights as a condition of legal validity, as a condition the violation of which defeats the presumed validity of an otherwise valid enactment or decision. And so I try to capture that in this formulation I've got up on the screen. R is valid in system S if R, the rule, satisfies all non-moral source-based conditions of validity N contained within S's rule of recognition, unless R violates M1, M2, and M3, or M1 through M3 are the moral conditions, like due process and so on. Now, I've got that unless clause in there to bring out the way in which the feasibility is often expressed. M1 through M3 designate defeasibility conditions on validity. Now, what are the advantages of conceiving a legal validity this way in systems with constitutional moral provisions? Now, here are some of them, I think. First, it allows us to make the point that usually, in normal run-of-the-mill cases, validity follows if non-moral tests are satisfied. And normally, that's all you have to do to establish. That's all you have to establish if you wish to know which rules are valid rules of your legal system. Because most of the legislation that's introduced in a legal system will comply with the moral conditions, if they comply with the source-based conditions. Now, conceiving of legal validity this way further highlights a point made earlier when I alluded to Austin, that most legal systems actually require that we, and this includes citizens, judges, police officers, and other legal officials, they require that we presume validity and act on that basis. That's what the system expects from us. Those systems tend to require this at least till such time as a violation of a constitutional moral test has been established in a court of law. In other words, at least till such time as someone is actually able to defeat the presumption in favor of validity by establishing, in accordance with whatever standard of certainty the system requires, a failure to meet the overriding moral conditions of validity. However, conceiving of validity as potentially defeasible property in relation to law also highlights and finds theoretical room for the important points insisted upon by defenders of ILP. Among these are the following. When the violation of a constitutionally recognized... When the violation of a constitutionally recognized moral condition is established in a way which defeats the presumption in favor of validity, the conclusion to be drawn and acted on by a court, indeed the conclusion that is typically drawn on and acted upon by courts in most legal systems that I'm aware of, is not that the offending enactment or decision is ripe for invalidation. Rather, the conclusion drawn and acted on is that the offending measure never was valid in the first place. And it was invalid because it's violated the Constitution. Now, legal systems have various ways of giving expression to that way of looking at matters, that the thing never was valid. For example, the person who issued the challenge and who might have been earlier convicted or held liable under the defeasibly valid law will be exonerated. Indeed, in some systems, and this is true in Canada, He will also be provided whatever compensation the court deems just and appropriate in the circumstances. That's what the Canadian Constitution actually requires. Just and appropriate because of the treatment he received under a law which has now been shown to have been invalid all along, including the time when he acted. Now, conceiving of validity as defeasible in that way, I think, allows us to explain all these features of legal practice in a better way than the directed powers account. For recall that on that account, there was indeed valid law which the defendant violated when he acted, or not, if he was required to do something, so as to bring the force of the law down upon his head. To be sure, it was valid law which the judge was empowered to invalidate, but it was, at the time of the action, nevertheless valid law. And so we're left struggling to explain why exoneration is the inevitable result, and why remedies might be thought to be appropriate if the person was actually violating what was then valid law, which has only subsequently been invalidated. For after all, why should someone be compensated for violating laws which were valid when he acted, and which only became valid only after and when the court later struck it down? The directed powers account provides no ready answer. I'm not saying that it can't provide an answer, but it's going to be stretched. But the account that I'm offering here does so without, I think, denying the facts of legal practice to which defenders of ELP and ILP all rightly draw our attention. Okay, so my conclusion on all of this. Defeasibility is a multifaceted notion. Anybody that looks at the literature realizes that it means so many different things to so many different people. My purpose in this paper has been to explore only some of those facets and to ask whether they pose any particular difficulties for legal positivism. And my conclusion is this. Not only is defeasibility a notion which makes little trouble for legal positivism, it highlights many key features of legal practice to which positivists have rightly drawn our attention. For example, the fact that law contains the seeds or the means for its own development. It's also a notion which points us in the direction of a solution to one of the most thorny issues to have divided contemporary positivists over the past 30-odd years, and that's that dispute between inclusive and exclusive positivists. Okay, that's it. Thank you.